Thank you. So welcome back from lunch, and I'm chairing again because this is my favorite part of the day, the super controversial discussion about goodwill and impairment. Before we jump into the discussion, I just wanted to say, everybody, please feel free to check your travel schedules and any time that you feel you need to leave to have a good chance of catching your train or plane, please feel free to do so. For those of you who don't spend a lot of snow days in London, it can get really, really bad here, so it's not comparable to, you know, what Boston or Toronto would do in a blizzard. So even if it doesn't look that bad to you, it can get very bad. So this will not in any way affect your attendance record.
That came out.
So as everybody's starting to check their travel updates, I'll just hand over to Rageva, starting on the first topic of the intangible assets.
Yeah, I'll ask my colleague Wongi to tee up the paper.
Yeah, good afternoon. In this session, we'd like to seek your views about first using a head-on approach to improve the effectiveness of impairment testing for Goodwill, and second, separate recognition of intangible assets according to business combination. We'd like to use more of your time on intangible issues and less of your time on head-on approaches, because we already had one-to-one meeting with some of you toward the end of 2017. So for effective discussion, I will tee up intangible issue first and open up the meeting with your comments, and then move on to the head-on approach. So page number 5 to 7 briefly explain the background and the current status of the board discussion on the research project. And then let's move to the intangible issue first on page number 22 to 28. Page 22 summarizes the feedback about intangibles we heard from the PIR by Part 3. And page 23 explains four approaches now we are considering. We are planning to discuss this approach with the board in April board meeting. Definitely, we will consider your feedback in analyzing these approaches. Possible approaches about intangible issues are first, retaining current requirement of IFRS 3, which is requiring all identifiable intangible assets acquired in a business combination separately from goodwill. And second, together with current requirement, providing additional disclosure about valuation technique input used in valuing intangible assets acquired in a business combination, which are similar to those in IFRS 13 fair value measurement. Third one is allowing indefinite life intangible assets to be subsumed within goodwill. Last one is segregate intangible assets into wasting intangible assets and organically replaced intangible assets, and require only wasting intangible to be recognized separately from goodwill. Steps concerned on each approach are set out on page 24 to 27. And I will catch on to you about this issue on page 28. We would like to discuss the question one after another, the other. So the second question we ask you is, do you think separate recognition of identifiable assets in BizCom provides useful information? Any comment or feedback about discussion?
Yes, Martez.
Thank you.
We were waiting for someone else, but it's going to have to be you.
I waited some time before I put up my nose, really. But I can no longer resist. This is the acquisition-related intangibles other than goodwill.
Yeah.
Are invariably extremely judgmental. I think that's the feedback from the preparer.
Yep. No.
It is the feedback from the investor. It's actually common sense that creating that was really not the greatest idea that got in the standards. Actually, this—I think we're all much better by just recognizing that it is all goodwill. I mean, if you only recognize those assets that can be created by the company themselves as well. I mean, if they're like clear telecom licenses, I mean, that those are intangibles that relate to the reality investors and companies communicate with each other. The acquisition-related intangibles, other than goodwill, do not relate to any discussion, meaningful discussion with investors, and they are heavily distrusted. Ideally, the ISB could get rid of those. And what do we do then? And I think the alternative, the best alternative, is to just consider them goodwill. I mean, that's the most logical one as well. Then you get rid of the cost of estimating those, justifying them, getting an auditor to sign off on it, which is actually incredible given how judgmental it is. But basically, they can sign off on anything. Because, I mean, so let's all recognize that goodwill. Is it a great idea to replace it with a wasting or a non-wasting? I mean, that's just not solving the problem. I mean, it's again very judgmental. So it would actually reduce cost and by just sticking it to goodwill. Yeah. So it's not useful.
Could I ask clarification, Martijn, because you seem to be implying that there were some intangibles you thought should be recognized, and I wasn't quite clear which category that was.
Well, for example, if a telecom company already owns a license to operate on a certain bandwidth, it would recognize that as an intangible, but not as an acquisition-related intangible, just as an intangible.
So is the distinction one that it could be easily acquired separately, externally, in a separate transaction? Is that the distinction you're aiming at?
Yes, if it would have probably, yeah, that's like, I mean, you're still in a fair value environment that you write up the assets to fair value. I mean, we're not discussing that. So in the meantime, you could say that what would be the fair value of that license if you had to acquire it, and would IFRS allow you to put it on your balance sheet? And yes, IFRS would allow you to put a license for 10 years on your balance sheet. Therefore, it's allowed to be activated on acquisition, whatever the book value of that asset at that moment in time is.
I guess I'm still not entirely clear what your two categories are, the ones that you would recognize and the ones that you wouldn't.
The ones I wouldn't recognize are those intangible assets that only are created currently as a consequence of acquisition, like customer lists, like the usual suspects.
Or would it be correct to say that what you don't want to be recognized is intangibles internally generated by the acquiree?
Yeah.
Intangibles internally generated by the acquired company.
Yeah. Okay.
Would that be a fair summary of what you would not want to get recognized?
Yeah, exactly. Internally generated intangibles are not recognized by any company, and then suddenly they appear currently when they're acquired. Well, yeah, that's so it would make it simpler. And it actually, the current practice is that it's not always clear whether a specific intangible asset is an acquisition-related intangible, or a truly rightfully activated intangible, as a consequence of, for example, a research program. And we actually had a discussion with ASML on this, and they said, "Well, we we cannot distinguish between those two categories ourselves. I mean, that's difficult.
So I'm more clarification. So if you would like, if you can have both internally generated goodwill of the acquirer and acquiree are recognized, then you are going to say yes to recognize these intangible internally generated goodwill of the acquiree separately.
Yes, so but I do not suggest to change the recognition criteria for intangible, for internally generated intangible assets. Keep them as they are. That works just fine. And only if it meets the criteria of internally generated intangibles, then you can fair value them, just probably as it is already done today.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Clarification.
Carlos?
Yes, first of all, I like the part of the launch because as investors, most investors, they get this PPA amortization and they just, you know, adjust their numbers for that kind of thing. So I don't think it's useful information the way it's done now. Having said that, so I partially agree with Martin, but having said that, I like a lot your proposal number 5. Of you know creating the distinction between wasting intangible assets and because there are certain and I think the telecom license example that you gave and I can talk about you know any kind of right of use or concession that a company may have and you may pay for a concession obviously that may generate goodwill and that's usually amortized you know I think that's relevant information and I guess that the way I would distinguish you know this from buying a portfolio of clients or buying it's or buy a brand even a brand right? it's because you know the portfolio of clients is part of our day-to-day business to recycle that portfolio of clients and on your P&L you're already considering that the yearly expenses will consider that you are renovating that goodwill that you paid for. In the case of a concession, you may or may not. Right? You just, you know, you may decide that you know someone else is bidding a higher price, and you may not pay the same for the concession. So and that's very very interesting information. So I think that's very important information. So the concept of wasting intangibles, I think it's an interesting concept, and I think it makes a lot of sense and could be useful for investors.
So I agree with Martin that the distinction between wasting and non-wasting assets is very, very fluffy. And I actually think there is no such thing as an infinite life asset. I mean, you basically, I mean, as I think you just pointed out, Carlos, you have to update and rejuvenate every brand that you buy. So I think basically, I mean, all of these assets should really be depreciable. And I can sort of see where people are coming from when they say it's unfair to distinguish between externally and internally generated goodwill or intangibles or whatever. But I still think there is a difference between, you know, management making an acquisition, at least putting their money where their mouth is. Their judgment might not always be the best, but at least they put money on the table to management just saying, oh, we think this is what, you know, our brand or our client list is worth. So I would actually, I don't ever want to see internally generated sort of goodwill on the balance sheet. And I also don't want it to be allowed through the back door or through the headroom approach, you know, as we've discussed before. And I guess we'll get to this. I also think that, you know, whenever possible, we should actually take intangible assets outside of goodwill. So I would actually lean towards an approach where the companies are just very honest and saying, you know, these are the intangible assets that we actually did the acquisition for, that we paid for, and we recognize them and we depreciate them over their useful life, even though that might be a bit arbitrary to estimate. And on the other hand, we have goodwill, which is really the residual that we can't allocate. Because I think, you know, the whole goodwill concept is quite flawed in the sense that you really put depreciable assets into goodwill. So, you know, a client list might be a little bit fluffier than, let's say, a brand, but that doesn't actually mean that it's going to have an infinite life. And if anything, it should have a slightly shorter life, so it should depreciate faster. But what we do is we put it into a goodwill and park it there forever. And the other thing is that goodwill is then this bizarre mix between intangibles that are not, that are too intangible to even be recognized as an intangible, and between synergies that are future expected synergies that are getting paid out to the shareholders of the acquiree. And I'm actually, I think it's very flawed that the goodwill sits on the balance sheet forever, because it's basically taking a view of future cash flow streams and NPVs. And as the future becomes the present and the past, these cash flows will either have materialized and will then have found their way through the P&L into the equity and will be double counted, or they have not materialized, in which the goodwill should really be depreciated. So I think the best way around that is really to actually make everything that looks like an asset into an intangible asset. And as a business owner, you know, I really don't think that your client lists are in any way intangible, or less tangible than other intangibles. I mean, you know, this is really why it takes time to build a business, because you need to convince the clients, you need to meet with them, you need to give them some sort of a trial period, and there is a certain stickiness after a while. And the whole point of buying a business a lot of times can really be that you just want to, you know, not have to start from scratch and spend all that money money internally and have a lot of fixed cost while you're trying to build your client base. And my very final comment would also be that I don't think we should sort of differentiate between different assets depending on how they found their way into the company. So anything that is sort of, you know, comes from an acquiree in some shape or form, you know, if you paid money for it, it should be recognized as an asset. And next is Jeff.
Oh, no, I put mine down.
Okay, sorry, it's James.
Yes. First of all, in case some are not aware, the bank perspective on the, of all this was this whole area of goodwill versus acquired intangibles was an area of extreme arbitrage, cheating, before Basel III and European CRR. Diluted by European lobbying, the measures against it were somewhat diluted by European lobbying. The point is that today bank regulation takes off all those intangibles, or will have done by 2019. There are other areas where I do see the same abuses. It is to do with acquired intangibles that are not goodwill, and these are in non-bank regulated entities, ongoing stock exchanges and asset management mergers. And there, clearly, I've been on roadshows by people doing big deals where they very clearly say, we don't have to, we're going to just do a complete revaluation of these acquired intangibles. And it's just an area of total manipulation, as far as I can see. This I think it's fair that if you bought it to that accounting, if you bought it as intangibles that were like Martijn's licenses and so forth, or some of the self-developed, whether it's software or whatever, can be licensed. I don't see it. I think what has to be avoided is those suddenly becoming upwardly revalued by the acquirer. So as to reduce sort of net tangible assets, where only goodwill is deducted, and that's what happens in quite a lot of regulation still, where it's only goodwill that's deducted from any regulatory capital base. So I'm looking at it sort of from my financial angle, but this whole area of manipulating acquired intangibles, if this addresses acquired intangible other than goodwill, then I would welcome this.
So James, just to clarify, then you would have those ones
subsumed into goodwill, because that would then be cleaner, and
that would
take away the manipulation from a balance sheet point of
view. Well, definitely what I'm totally against is an upward valuation at acquisition.
Fair valuing.
Yeah, exactly. The fair valuing of those at acquisition just to make a deal seem to work and not to have capital, regulated capital, to, capital constraints.
Okay, Tricky. Maybe it's helpful to also formulate then the an alternative for fair valuing, because I sympathize very much with James. An alternative, you could also say, okay, if you acquire a company, you don't fair value every asset, because that actually distorts the financial accounts of the new entity as a whole, because some of the assets then are at fair value and the other ones, so the depreciation on those assets is suddenly a few years a lot higher because they're fair value. And what you could, an alternative approach is to say, okay, so this is the target company, and we have the financials of the target company, and we're not going to fair value every individual asset. We just say, what would those financial statements have looked like if they had applied IFRS, like the company, like the acquiring company? And then you get very little distortion. Yes, that's judgmental. It is judgmental. But it will be much more in line with... I think it would result in...
Bigger goodwill, though, wouldn't you, Martin?
Sorry?
You get much bigger goodwill.
Yeah.
Yes, you do.
Much, much bigger goodwill.
Yes, but the if you want to see what kind of capex is needed to replace, your depreciation charge will be more accurate. So based on the depreciation charge, you can better estimate what the capex level should be, because immediately after acquiring a company, it looks like the company is underinvesting its assets as opposed to if they were standalone, because the depreciation charge goes up a lot because all those assets have a write-up. And so it becomes the capex to depreciation becomes easier to model. And so I think it's as an alternative to the fair valuing currently. Fair valuing is actually quite costly, I understood. And since 140 countries in the world now apply IFRS, it's even more feasible than at the time there were only 80. You know, it's probably, if you do an acquisition, you have a 1 in 8 chance that it is probably applying IFRS anyway. So how difficult would it be to just apply IFRS as the acquiring company does?
Also, just wanted to reply to James. I mean, I think I'm very sympathetic to the first part of your statement, in the sense that, even if, an approach sounds conceptually sound, if we fear that there is going to be manipulation that we are not going to really be able to get under control with any accounting standards and any stipulations as to how the math should be done, that we might then say, okay, we'd rather see this in goodwill than some artificial intangibles number. But I think in terms of your comment on the regulator, I'm a little bit nervous that we're sort of, doing things in reverse. I mean, I think the remit of the ISB should be to come up with, the most accurate, most reliable numbers possible. And then we should always be encouraging regulators to do the right thing and to say, you're deducting goodwill from the capital requirements, but actually some of these intangible assets are called intangible assets because they're very intangible. It's very hard to say whether they're really going to be generating the return that's implied. So you should be deducting that as well, instead of doing it the other way around and saying, okay, the regulator is so stupid that they actually, don't deduct a lot of the things that they should be deducting. So we move them from one bucket to another to make sure they do get deducted.
Dangerous to assume the regulators are stupid. It's true.
I was just paraphrasing, just to make this a little bit more entertaining. Okay, yeah, Patron.
Yes, I remember the one comment. The goodwill is created by a transaction when one company is paying for buying another company. And with respect to the intangibles that you may find within the company you acquire, I would make the difference between intangibles, where you can put a transaction where the intangibles, you can sell them or you can make a transaction with these intangibles, as compared to the other one, which are subject to evaluation process and are not subject to a transaction, independent transaction. So I would have much more, I would say, confidence in the first type kind of intangible assets, where there is potentially a transaction outside of this specific transaction, as compared to the other one, where it's subject to evaluation process with a lot of assumptions to be made. So in the latter case, I doesn't consider that it brings me too much information or useful information, because it's a result of a valuation process that is subject to discussion potentially with different people and also investors that may have their different view of the outcome.
So Nick?
Yeah, just to pick up on a couple of things. I think, Marietta, you said the job was to come up with the most accurate numbers. I think we're coming up with the most useful numbers. Most accurate numbers, and they may be different things sometimes. That's what I make the point. I guess, just trying to draw together some of the threads, for me, I think we sort of touched upon it. The problem is this disconnect between assets in this category that are acquired and those which are generated internally. There's a different accounting treatment, and that results in less comparability between companies. And I think it's that disconnect that is the heart of this issue. And you're right, John Moore said there are a couple of ways to deal with that. Either you say, right, we will now start recognising some of these organically in terms of customer lists or brands, or we subsume perhaps into goodwill the ones which we have acquired. But I think it is that disconnect which starts to break down comparability in terms of looking from one company to another, which then results in many analysts adding back this number. And also, in my practical experience, I have found getting to grips with this number extraordinarily difficult in terms of saying, actually, breaking down the PPA amortization. Actually, some of this is around, perhaps there's an element of software within there, which I do want to treat akin to depreciation. But I'm struggling to strip out the brand element and the customer list element. The disclosure hasn't been breakered here hitherto.
But the other possible disconnect that can be, and if we go down this path of, for example, taking over the pre-acquisition carry amounts or an estimate of the acquisition carry amounts, the other disconnect you create then is compared with a transaction where you acquire the assets individually rather than acquiring them as part of a business combination. Because if you acquired, let's say, your license separately, then obviously you'll pay whatever that is for that, which is probably approximately fair value. So if we ended up with a different treatment of the business combination, then we create a different kind of disconnect as well.
Yeah, not completely agree, because it is different between buying a new asset and buying a portfolio of very new and very old assets. And if they both apply already IFRS, I mean, it is so easy. It is so much easier to just take it in as it is. If you're talking about cost savings, if you're talking about usefulness, it is cheaper and it's more useful. we should be sensitive to that somehow. And yeah, it does generate more goodwill. But in fact, probably that economically is what is happening. So actually, you could argue that goodwill is artificially low if you do it on a fair value basis. Maybe.
I just wanted to quickly comment, Nick, on your comment around the comparability. I mean, I think in general, I'm very much in favor of comparability. But I also think it is very useful to be able to see at a glance when two companies have totally different business models. And I mean, the FRC was actually looking into a business model reporting project, because a lot of times the companies don't actually communicate clearly enough exactly, you know, how they go about building their business and making their money. And so I think if you actually look at two sets of accounts and you have one company that has a very big balance sheet, but relatively high profitability in this period and in the past, because they've sort of, you know, bought in a lot of the things that someone else had to build organically, and that other guy actually has, you know, a very lean balance sheet but has sort of very high charges in areas like, you know, marketing that you need to build a brand, that kind of already tells you how they go about building their business. And I think that's already a very useful starting point, so I don't think that's necessarily a big negative. And I just wanted to add from my comment earlier, and I mean, Glenn, I think you had a very fair point that, you know, you shouldn't just call somebody stupid, but I think my comment also was not just referring to regulators. I mean, you can extend that comment to any group of investors and analysts. You can always say, well, you know, people are not going to know what to make of these numbers, so we're going to abandon a really good standard and replace it with a really poor standard just because we think that people are going to do something more intelligent off of it. And so, I mean, I think that's just sort of like my general comment, that I think, you know, we shouldn't be too worried about what people are going to be doing with it, but, you know, what they should be doing with it and how they should be educated.
Can't you solve that by disclosure? Just voluntary disclosure. If a company wants to disclose some sort of a purchase price allocation, well, why justify why it is so much worth it as they pay? I mean, it's a bit of a tough thing to enforce it in primary financial statements.
But I think, I mean, yeah, I'm just unhappy with the whole goodwill concept and the bizarre mix of, you know, having assets in there and synergies in there that you then never sort of write down. I mean, if you want to take the view that basically, you know, any amount that is paid for anything that's not a tangible asset could potentially be too much, then yes, I'm with you. Then I think we should just lump it all into goodwill. But then, you know, I'm always the purist. I would like to see it written off against equity immediately and just say, okay, you know, these guys just blew the equity on something that may or may not pay off, and let the market be the judge.
Well, there's a big distinction between buying an asset and buying a company, because a company, even if you value a company,
come on, I'm not going to fail my company.
If you value a company, your assumption is that the company, you buy it for life, not for a lifetime. You buy it for life. So there is a strong theoretical underpinning of saying, oh, we're not going to write on that. Because if you buy a company, you buy it for life. If you don't want to buy it for life, you buy an asset. Why go in the whole complication of buying a company if you just want to have an asset? Usually, you buy a company for life. If you model a company, you have like an exit multiple that is like representing the cash flows indefinite. So it actually hooks in how companies value their targets. It hooks in how analysts value their targets on a continuing basis. So therefore, you do not write off unless there's an impairment.
I suggest that at some point we have a coffee and you tell me about the best exit strategy for my business, but I think for now I'll hand over to Tom, who's been waiting very patiently. Tom first, and then
I just have a very quick clarification which would help me. I think Nick mentioned the distinction between internally generated and acquired in a combination. And I just want to understand what troubles people, whether it's valuing the individual items in the acquisition or just valuing intangibles. And I want to introduce a third group. So suppose we buy, name any intangible, in a one-on-one, just that's all you bought. You bought the patent, you bought the whatever. And for the people who don't like it being allocated in a combination, what would you do with just the absolutely clear, I paid $1,000 for a single intangible? I just want to understand like where people are from on this.
I don't think I understand.
Expensive.
Well, you said you didn't like the in the
fair
purchase,
yeah,
because you couldn't tell the fair values. If all you buy is a single intangible where $1,000 crosses, there's no doubt that the $1,000 is linked unequivocally to that intangible. It's not like a combination. So I just want to know what your accounting is for that transaction.
The key problem is not that it's not possible to find the fair value. Obviously, people find fair value for assets all the time. So the problem is, what is useful information to process? And it's more useful to have capex to depreciation not distorted. It will make life easier of analysts to make projections if half of the asset base or all of the asset base is more or less on the same principles valued, instead of half of the assets based on amortized cost and the other one on fair value. And then 4 years down the road, of course it doesn't matter anymore, but you have 4 years of distortion. And that's so if you want to model a company, its cash flows, writing up all assets to fair value or down makes it more complicated.
Okay.
So I want to. That's the. Is that make that sense?
Yeah, but that basically means you
want.
But I think Glenn was first, though. I don't know. Is it? I mean, do you want to speak first?
I shared the sort of points that the points that Tom is making, which is, I understand that there's an issue here, but this is one of those situations where we've got a debate between perfection and what is good. The principle is undoubtedly the case that, you know, you acquire intangible assets, you can create them. We treat them completely differently in the financial statements. But the question is, does it matter? Because at the end of the day, the real value of these things is being contested in the stock market every day. That's why the share prices are going up and down. They're not going up and down for any other reason. They're going up and down because people are deciding what intangible value they want to attribute to the company. And the idea that, you know, the Accounting Standards Board is going to tell us something useful about this, I mean, it's for the birds, isn't it? Because I think it's totally for the birds.
The value of financial statements.
Yeah, but this is the debate that is going on in the market. We're just saying that the market has one view there and one view here, and there isn't a solution to this. We're going to debate this. Even if you put a number down, the market's still going to give you a different answer. Because once you've attributed all this stuff to the intangibles and you have the goodwill, there'll be some other person that turns up and says, well, there's another intangible there that you haven't considered, and then it just goes round and round. So
just kind of, you wouldn't, I think you might be in the same place.
I wouldn't
recognize them.
I wouldn't recognize it, not because I think it's a better answer. I just don't think there is an answer to this. I think we have to accept, it's grammar. We have to accept the grammar of this, and this is one of those situations where, you know, we've got a rule breaker to the general principle of grammar. We've decided that this is the general principle and we're going to break the rules, and everyone's got to live with it and live with the grammar of the accounting that we work with. It's one of those situations where, if we go back to the previous session, I personally think we probably should spend a lot less time on it than we are.
But sorry, Glenn, just to be clear, so would you then actually be in favor of just taking an acquisition fully against equity at the time that it's made? Because basically, I mean, you're effectively saying, you know, capital is being spent, whether it's on sort of the projects being developed internally or on an external acquisition, and the capital's gone, and it's up to the stock market to see, you know, what cash flows can be generated in the future now.
Honestly, I don't think it matters. There used to be a time when we capitalized and didn't amortize goodwill, and then there was a time when we wrote it all off. It didn't make any difference. The market still traded like it did, and everyone knew how to interpret all the language around that. I actually don't think it matters. I know it's an issue, and in the perfect world, we'd have a way of attributing all this stuff to find the essence, but then we wouldn't need the market, you see. If we got that answer, we wouldn't need the market.
Okay,
you don't
can
think
I make
that
an
the
analogy?
Double counting matters that we get from having goodwill on the balance. You don't think the double counting matters that we get from having goodwill on the balance sheet and then having it come onto the balance sheet again when the actual cash flows materialize and
correct.
Go through the P&L. So you think that, okay, it's easy to adjust for the double counting.
Yeah, market does it all the time.
I
honestly think that. I think it's one of those situations where everyone knows it's an issue, but we know how to deal with it. It's one of those, you know, what I call the in grammar, it's the case, the, you know, it's the exception. It's the one that breaks the rule.
So then I would say Bertrand, and then Paolo, and then maybe we should just quickly move to the headroom discussion, and then in the discussion about headroom, anybody who still wants to add something from the discussion we've been having can do that as well.
Yes. Yes, I will make a comparison with tangible assets. Let's assume that you buy a company which run a bus. You have the opportunity to buy the company or to buy the bus. If you buy the company and you don't revalue the assets, in that case, what is the difference if you buy only the bus, which is the core asset of the company? If you buy the second-hand bus, you will incorporate the value of the pay for the second-hand bus into the assets of your own company. You see, do you understand?
No.
You have the choice.
What is a bus?
A bus.
A bus,
yes.
To drive in?
To drive in, yes.
Okay.
So you want a company which has only one bus to drive the people from one area to another area.
Yeah.
You have the choice to buy the bus or to buy the company. And at the end, you will make a transaction because you will pay for this company and for this bus with the driver of the bus. In that case, if you buy only the bus, you will incorporate the value of the bus you have paid for this, not the value of the bus which was into the company own financial statements. And that's the same, I would say, for the intangible assets. That means that you can buy a company with intangible assets, but if you are in a I would be not surprised to see in my own company the value of the intangible assets being what I would pay for this intangible asset if I would pay for it independently of the acquisition of the company. And I understand it may be disturbing that you are frustrating that you have inside your own company assets at historical cost, for example, and assets that are bought through an acquisition. And because maybe they are the same assets, but not with the same depreciation patterns, but at the beginning, you have had a transaction where you are paid for something you get. The other issue is that here you can have a value different because you pay for an asset that you can value differently through a separate acquisition if you are not buying the whole company. The other issue is that if you have another asset which you have to value, let's say like a customer list, that it's much more difficult to evaluate and where you have more subjectivity and maybe more less relevance.
That was a question.
All right.
So this means it's not a question, it's a comment that with regard to your comment regarding I would like to take my own the company assets into my asset at the same value. I think it's worthwhile to value them up to the market, or the fair value, something like that, or transaction value.
No, I disagree, but I see your point.
Yes, okay.
Okay, so you get to fight over it in the break very soon. And
A quick comment that in response to what you made. I have the feeling that what you're treating with an exception is more or less the rule nowadays. You see all the Googles of the world buying solutions created internally by three or four young guys that actually, devised some kind of software that solves a problem for Google. And then you buy that. It's a private company, so market prices do not apply. How do you treat that? Because that's basically the value that's internally generated by the acquired company.
I get paid a lot of money to answer that question, because people value companies all the time.
No, I mean, that's accounting-wise, not in terms of
worth. Once you know how much cash has to go out, you know the answer to the value that you're going
but
to put on those things.
How do you account for that? I mean, it's as goodwill or...
It doesn't matter. Once I know, if I'm going to pay $1 billion for a company, I don't care. I'm going to sit there and going to value the whole thing piece by piece by piece. It doesn't actually matter how I allocate the number, $1 billion, between the
intangibles. Then you do that. Then you do the PPA, and you are left with 995 million.
So what?
Unaccountable.
So what? I own the business 100%. I can control it. I can do everything I want with it. Who is gaining or losing by that?
Shall I give you an example? I mean, I've made this analogy before, so some people may get bored with me. Suppose I show you a gold medal in the 100 meters men at Olympics. I show it to you. Would it matter to you whether I bought that medal or I run it myself?
It would make a difference to me.
To you, it wouldn't make a difference.
Whether you don't.
Huh? It's
the question is, why are you showing it to me?
Because I want you to invest in me.
If you're showing it to me because you want me to buy it, it doesn't matter where you got it from, I'm going to value it.
I want
right?
you to invest in me. So if I am a company and I've shown, I can present to you, for example, a number one or two market position in four regions of the world, not three. would it matter to you as an investor whether I organically built this position?
No.
Or whether at one moment in time I had a big bag of money and was able to buy a company and acquired that position.
No, it wouldn't matter to me whether you bought it or you built it yourself. What would matter to me is if the thing that you had was sustainable. That's a completely different question. Because what I would really want to know, and I hope when you bought it, you also asked that question, am I buying something sustainable? Yeah. Because the question is, are there sufficient barriers to entry? Is there a sufficient moat around this business that ensures that what you have right now will carry on and for how long? So as you said, you're buying it for life, not lifetime. You know, not for the life and not the lifetime. That's what I want to know. How you got there, I don't care.
Well, to be honest,
friend,
to me, it does.
This is a very elegant bridge to headroom, by the way, so I don't know whether we should.
Thank you.
Well, it's up to Rageva. I mean, I don't know how important the headroom subject is versus.
What we were just thinking is, before we go to headroom, we just wanted to ask the last question on if you have any views on the approaches, you know, other than retaining any of the other three approaches. If you have any views, quickly, if you can give us those views, then we can move on to headroom.
Yeah, such as which approach you prefer?
I think a few of you have already indicated preference to some of the approaches, but others, if you have any preference or.
So last question.
Slide 23 has got the four different.
I mean, not many have spoken on the finite life versus indefinite life. I know a few of you have done. I mean, do you have any views on that or
disclosure?
You know, the IFRS 13 disclosures for intangible assets or.
In terms of indefinite life intangibles, apart from goodwill, are there many examples of such assets? So you know, you're proposing a split, but how useful or practical would it be in application?
I mean, that's my personal view. So as we said, we haven't still discussed this with board. I think the segregation between goodwill and indefinite life, to my mind, it'll be less of a disruption if we combine the two together, because subsequent accounting for goodwill and indefinite life assets is exactly the same. They're just tested for impairment. And then indefinite life intangible assets are not amortized. So going back to Martin's question, cost effective probably reduces cost for preparers. But we still have to analyze if there's any loss of information doing that.
My question is related exactly to that. Is it really saving time and effort and information? And that relates to my question about, do we really see indefinite live intangibles on balance sheets to a great extent?
Spectrum. Wired spectrum.
Concessions.
That's the definite life intangible.
Yeah, they are.
Indefinite life.
Spectrum.
Probably, I don't know, what about customers lists or brands? I mean, do you see them being categorized as indefinite life or?
I haven't.
It's the life.
It's amortized.
It's always amortized.
It's what?
Always amortized.
I guess it depends on the region.
There was a case in the Netherlands where Ziggo tried to activate and it got a slap on the wrist for doing that. And then they said, you know, that 1 billion customer list, let's all recognize that goodwill. So, sorry, yeah, that actually happened.
Just in the interest of time, my view is that there aren't many indefinite-lived intangibles, and therefore what you're proposing isn't a time saver or a practical shortcut, because it wouldn't be used in application. I think the only other thing I would say is, as primarily concerned with banks, I don't care about goodwill or in the split. It's just, we just deduct it. We're looking at capital, and it's not part of capital. But, you know, for simplicity, it feel, if I go back, why this split came out between goodwill and intangibles, again, I think it was a compromise between people who wanted to amortize goodwill and people who didn't, and they said, well, let's try and make goodwill smaller, not amortize it, and amortize everything else, and it hasn't really worked. So I would say, let's go back to goodwill, simple, and amortize it. That's not one of your options.
My main issue is just that basically all of the options that you've ever looked at and ever presented and ever implemented have been somewhat contradictory, inherently contradictory, as I sort of laid out before. And I mean, and so basically, you know, why do you want to try to tweak something that is already philosophically flawed? And I think Glenn would say, well, it doesn't matter because I can basically unwind it all and repair all of the nonsense that's going into the balance sheet. But you know, why show irrelevant numbers in the first place and then wait for investors to strip them out to have a proper balance sheet? So I mean, my approach is preference for approaches in that order would be one to simply expense the whole goodwill, intangible, blah, blah, blah stuff that you're acquiring and have the company explain why it's a good thing that they no longer have any equity but a brilliant future. And the second would be to identify as many intangible assets as possible, disaggregate them as much as possible, and let the market really have a good discussion with the management about, well, was it intelligent to actually pay this much for a workforce that's going to be resigning tomorrow, or for a list of clients that's going to be dying tomorrow, or whatever. And the third would be, if you really don't like intangible assets, just to put it all into goodwill, but then to really write it off at the time that you basically think at the time of acquisition this is coming through. So if you're paying $500 million for synergies and you think you're going to be achieving these synergies within 3 years, then 3 years down the road, I don't want to see them on the balance sheet anymore. And I think if you are a serial acquirer, that actually makes it a lot easier for people to see, you know, how much of the synergies, you know, we're still waiting for are going to be in the future and how much of it has already played out. But none of the other mishmash makes sense to me.
Okay.
Okay. I'm very excited to move to Hedron approach now. Okay. The Hedron approach is start from page 9 to 19. So at each December 2017 meeting, the board tentatively decide to consider using Hedron approach for improving the timely recognition of impairment of goodwill. As I mentioned before, we had a call with 11 senior members to discuss about this approach, and a good majority of the members supported this approach. So we summarize the feedback on slide 19. So the basic mechanics of this approach, including an example, are set out on page from 12 to 17, and page 18 set out the pros and cons of this approach. So with that, I'd like to ask you for your comments and feedback about this approach.
Alright, so any comments on the headroom? Or any other comments that people would like to make from before?
I got the impression that this approach is quite complex and difficult to understand, not only for preparers but even for users. I do agree that probably this approach will allow the preparers to recognize impairment much earlier than the current approach, but still that the my concern is that the, you know, yeah, like that the intangible discussion, that the basically this is based upon the variation of internally generated goodwill as well as the acquired goodwill. So that I have an impression that it's, you know, anyway, that the acquired goodwill is what you paid based upon what you paid for. But it is quite difficult it seems difficult and judgmental, and also it could be manipulated by the preparers how they estimate that it is recoverable amount. And that is my big concern. And it doesn't, I'm not very sure how, you know, cost competitive to the preparer. I think that the one of the, yeah, I'm the user, but the still that it was the one of the concern was that the current impairment test, annual impairment test, is too costly. How cost effective this is? And do you think that this is much less costly than the current impairment test?
No, we think this method can add some cost to current model. But now we are considering the other approach together with the updated approach, which can reduce the cost of applying IS statistics impairment model, such as simplification of value in, calculation of value in use. So if we consider all together, yeah, we can balance the cost and benefit.
So I think the treatment of any goodwill should be completely independent of, you know, how other parts of the business and other goodwill is doing. So on the internally generated goodwill, if we basically take a view that, you know, we're keeping that off the balance sheet normally for a company that doesn't make any acquisitions, then I don't think it's fair to allow it in through the back door, you know, for a company that makes a bad acquisition and has to write off their the goodwill from that acquisition, and basically say, oh, you know, well, never mind, because we've kind of always lowballed the value of the company in a way. And the same is true, I mean, if you make two acquisitions, so if you, you know, one of them goes against you and the other one performs better than you thought, you know, I don't think it's okay to just, you know, write up the goodwill of that first acquisition just because they happen to be effectively write it up, and write the other one down and be net neutral just because they happen to be lumped together in the same segment. And I just also really wanted to flag that I think what happens in reality is that there's always some part of the business that's going well and some part of the business that's not going so well, or some part of the business that seems to be going well. And I think, you know, we never get any transparency if we kind of let management, you know, just basically you know, report on the aggregate and say, yeah, some parts of the business are doing really poorly, we should write down the goodwill, but, you know, some other parts are doing a little bit better. So, you know, we're just basically saying nothing bad is happening overall. I don't think that's adding any information.
But we're not talking about introducing any more aggregation that's not already there. What we're talking about is applying the existing test and the outcome of the existing test. We're actually trying to reduce some of that aggregation effect, some of that shielding that comes in instances where the management has decided that the acquired goodwill is part of the larger cash generating units. So it's actually trying to do the opposite of reduce some of that effect.
Because without the headroom approach, the current impairment test would probably result in the outcome that you are suggesting, that internally generated goodwill comes into the books through backdoor. Because if you don't impair acquired goodwill when it ought to be impaired, then the effect is that the internally generated goodwill just replaces that you know, impairment loss that didn't get recognized. So the approach really tries to take away the shielding effect of the internally generated goodwill to force impairment when there is an impairment.
Yes, I'm all in favor of that. And I also would like to add that I think, you know, whether goodwill of, you know, pertaining to any particular asset or acquisition or whatever should be impaired or not, should not in any way be dependent on, you know, which segment management had at some point lumped it into. You know, it should sort of be viewed on an individual basis. Martin, and I think you even have time to pick up the last subject.
Great. I think this approach will not provide useful information. Let me give a very simple example. One acquisition only, and then we review it in 2 years. You do an acquisition, you recognize 500 million goodwill. Great. Next year, the value of the business goes up by another 500 million. Because the expectations are fantastic. So there's headroom of 500 million. The next year, the expectations go back to as they were. At that moment, there will be a 500 million goodwill charge.
Not necessary, because we have a rebuttable presumption in there. So it's for the management to explain.
If this simple example, if you have to refer to the rebuttable presumption here, I think it's weak. I mean, this should not, the way it's calculated should be stable enough that if you just a simple up and down, does not require a rebuttable presumption to, because if nothing really happened, it just went up and down to the original price. And then you need to justify why you did not write off 500 million goodwill. I think this is only one example with one acquisition. If you try to do this with a company that has a history of 40 acquisitions, it will become a mess.
Which is the norm, really.
Yeah. So if it doesn't work for one acquisition, I think we have to be doubtful whether this will work for many acquisitions.
And
it's a false signal, then the goodwill write-down of 500 million is a false signal. Because then you say, yeah, we wrote down goodwill, 500 million, but we still have 500 million headroom. What's that signal? I mean, it's a strange signal.
Any final comments from the ISB before we move to the rate-regulated activities?
Could I actually go back to the previous question, if that's okay? I wanted to explore a little bit more. So what I'm hearing about on the previous question is just the questionable value of goodwill, questionable value of fair valuing the acquiree and the intangibles there. And I'm trying to reconcile that with some comments that I heard at the previous meeting where there was a desire for goodwill to be disaggregated by individual business combinations and to be able to understand the performance of those business combinations. So from that perspective, it sounds like there might actually be some value in those numbers. So,
Definitely. I mean, there is value in the decomposition of the balance sheet number of goodwill,
mm-hmm.
and to what kind of what acquisitions resulted in the is it how is the amount on the balance sheet attributable to the acquisitions made in the past?
Mm-hmm. So
and ideally, a company should only be allowed to make a acquisition part of a cash generative unit, which no investor ever saw. I mean, they're not reported. But if it has no other choice to do so,
mm.
So ideally, I mean, it's not like there should be an option to make it part, but only if you cannot reasonably be expected to monitor the individual acquisition, you're allowed to put it into a cash generative unit, and in many cases it will be possible. In many cases it will not be necessary to put it in a CGU, and you can still monitor how the business progresses post acquisition, and that information is most relevant in the first, say, 8 years after the acquisition. After 8 years, the CEO is gone. I mean,
the last nobody, 8 years in your nobody. Industry? Wow, and mine's like 2 to 3.
Oh, 4 years. Sorry. but there's nobody to hold accountable for. So this is actually, from a stewardship perspective, this is very useful information, especially in the first years after the acquisition. So let's focus on getting the most out of this in the first 5 years, 7 years, 8 years after the acquisition. See what you can come up with. And yeah, the composition of goodwill does add. If we engage with companies, it often is on, okay, how come you paid 1.7 billion for over the past 7 years for companies that had operating profit of combined 10 million? This is real life. I'm not kidding.
Exactly.
I mean,
it's the cash that they've paid. The cash is good. That is the economics of the transaction, isn't it? When it's struck, that's what matters.
Yeah.
What you pay for it.
That's the thing.
Marietta, could I ask your indulgence and ask one more really quick question? Because we've only got 2 minutes, I'm going to ask it as a leading question, so I apologize for that. One of the options the team looked at was trying to improve the disclosures about acquired intangibles, because there's this concern about whether they're about how difficult they are to value. Now, and so the suggestion was maybe some of the existing disclosures that are required for recurring fair value measurements would be extended to apply in a business combination as well. Now, I'm guessing from what I've heard around the table that those of you who've got concerns about the valuation of the intangibles, probably adding those disclosures wouldn't be enough to eliminate those concerns. It probably wouldn't change your position. That's my guess from what I've heard around the table, but I wanted to just try and test that.
I think that's a fair assumption.
Yeah, I think I'm seeing a lot of nodding.
Yeah,
that's probably some useful information.
Okay, great. So, thank you very much to the IRC.